This is Talking History. Talking History is a weekly radio program focusing on history. It examines our past and how we recall it, how we preserve it, how we interpret it, and how we transform it into myth. Talking History is a co-production of the University at Albany History Department, State University of New York, WRPI-FM Troy, and the Department of History, Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska. Welcome to Talking History. On October 15, 1998, scholars from the History and Political Science departments at the University at Albany conducted a public forum to discuss the Clinton scandal, constitutional crisis, or politics as usual. Professor Dan White, chair of the Department of History at the University at Albany, introduced the topic and the panel.
When we look back a century from now, we look back into history to 1898, we think of the Spanish-American War. When Americans a century from now look back to 1998, they're likely also to think of a war, but an internal conflict centering on the president. But what kind of struggle is it? What is it about? These are the questions that form the topic for today's panel. How it will come out, we do not know. Unfortunately, such speculation is the main theme of most of the commentary of the talking heads on Sundays. They generally rehash events, talk about the newest piece of news, and then spend most of their time speculating on what's going to happen. Here instead, the panel wants to look at what lies behind the struggle. What are the forces in play to help us see what is the nature of this controversy? Is it constitutional conflict? Is it politics as usual? To help answer these questions, we have a panel of scholars. First is Martin Edelman, professor of political science at the Rockefeller College, the author of Democratic Theories and the Constitution, and of Courts, Politics, and Culture in Israel, and has written both about the American Constitution and Israeli courts. Next is Professor Bruce Miroff, who's professor of political science and chair of the Political Science Department. He is the author of Pragmatic Illusions, The Presidential Politics of John F. Kennedy, and of Icons of Democracy, American Leaders as Heroes, Aristocrats, Dissenters, and Democrats. He's written on political theory as well as political leadership and the presidency. Next is Julian Zelizer, Assistant Professor of History, a specialist in 20th century America. Julian's book, Taxing America, Wilbur Mills, Congress and the State, 1945 to 1975. He's currently at work on a study of congressional reform. And Richard Hamm, Associate Professor of History. Richard teaches courses in legal history. He is the author of Shaping the 18th Amendment, Temperance Reform, Legal Culture and the Polity, 1880 to 1920, and currently awaiting publication of a book called Four Virginia Murder Trials, The Press and Virginia Justice, 1868 to 1937. That's your panel. They're going to speak in the following order. Professor Hamm and Edelman, who talk about the Constitution, and then Professors Zelizer and Miroff, who will talk more about politics.
Legal historian Richard Hamm.
In the current political atmosphere brought on by the Independent Counsel's report to the House and the House vote to hold impeachment hearings, the nation has been awash, just awash in statements concerning impeachment. Reporters, pundits, politicians, spin doctors are all culling the historical record to find materials and statements to support their point of view. The words impeachable offense and high crimes and misdemeanors have been batted about quite a bit, and definitions from the past have been widely quoted and disseminated. One of the most popular quoted statements is from then Congressman Gerald Ford, who in 1970 said on the floor of the Congress, "What then is an impeachable offense? The only honest answer is that an impeachable offense is whatever a majority of the House of Representatives considers it to be at a given moment in history. Conviction results from whatever offense two-thirds of the other body, the Senate, considers to be sufficiently serious to require removal of the accused from office." End of quote. Now, Ford has captured the very essentials of the issue, because the truth of the matter is the 535 members of the House and Senate who will determine what an impeachable offense is. But they will do so under the very peculiar rules of the impeachment process. For those who think that Ford's statements and other statements like it point to a very slippery slope that will lead and guarantee Bill Clinton's conviction, I warn you that is not so. Because impeachment, especially of a president, was designed to be a very difficult matter, not very easily accomplished. Impeachment itself is an old process. As early as the 14th century, the 1300s, Parliament in England was using the power of impeachment against royal officials. The House of Commons, which many called the grand jury of the nation, impeached, that is, indicted, and the House of Lords, which was recognized as, quote, the greatest court of justice in Britain, tried the case. The convicted official was both removed and subjected to severe penalties, often including death and corruption of the blood. That means all of his heirs were stripped of their property rights. During the 17th century struggles between Parliament and the Crown, impeachment was one of the many powers used by the Parliament to establish its supremacy in the English government. Parliament also used other devices, most specifically, importantly, bills of attainder, acts that targeted one individual, usually a royal official, subjected him to criminal punishment for a previous act. An official act subjected to punishment for it. Often the attainder was for treason, which meant a death sentence and corruption of the blood for the heirs. So attainder was usually what we call an ex post facto law. After 1700, Parliament also had at its power that by mere majority vote of both houses, Commons and Lords, it could address, that is, ask the monarch to remove an officer from the government. American colonial legislatures in the colonial period used both powers of impeachment and legislative address. In the burst of constitution making that marked the American Revolution, impeachment and address moved into our frames of government. They were widely adopted. At least 10 state constitutions before the 1787 federal constitution contained clauses authorizing impeachment. At least 8 state constitutions adopted before the federal constitution contained provisions for legislative address. Why did the American revolutionaries adopt these processes? They adopted them to protect the sovereign people against the abuse of governmental authority. Remember that the fundamental feature of constitutional making was limitation on governmental authority. Americans wrote constitutions at the inception of the republics because they feared abuse of authority, and they even feared abuse of legislative authority, and so they would hedge impeachment or legislative address with procedural guarantees so they couldn't be easily used. They designed their powers to be difficult to invoke. Indeed, the power of impeachment, of removal from office in the federal constitution, was specifically limited and restrained. Now, it's important to note that the framers of the constitution rejected some things in designing the impeachment clause, the impeachment process, it's actually in several different clauses of the constitution. They rejected the broad, unlimited powers of Parliament. The constitution explicitly denies Congress and the states the powers to pass bills of attainder and ex post facto laws. Also, the framers of the Constitution ignored legislative address in creating their document. In choosing impeachment over address, the framers chose a judicial means of removal, admittedly one that was going to be run by politicians, they knew that, to to a more purely political means of removal. The framers actually said that impeachment was a judicial proceeding, as Article 3 declares that all criminal trials will be by jury, except in cases of impeachment. Significantly, the Constitution also sets up some procedural hurdles, guarantees, and safeguards against abuse. When the Senate sits for impeachment, the senators shall be on oath or affirmation. Moreover, when the President of the United States is tried, the Chief Justice shall preside. This is clearly so the Vice President won't preside, as he usually does or she does, over the Senate and benefit by removing their predecessor from office. Of course, most daunting put into the impeachment process is no person shall be convicted without the concurrence of two-thirds of the members present, the same standard of supermajority used in treaties and amendments to the Constitution. The penalty for impeachment does not extend any further than removal from office and disqualification to hold and enjoy any office, honor, trust, or profit under these United States. But the party convicted shall nevertheless be liable and subject to indictment, trial, judgment, and punishment according to law, period, end quote. Similarly, the president is denied the power of pardon when it comes to impeachment, so a president could not protect a political crony from the process if the crony was impeached and removed. But most significantly, the Constitution defines what are the grounds for impeachment. Quote, the president, vice president, and all civil officers of the United States shall be removed from office on impeachment for and conviction of treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. This is a very interesting list. This is why we have a debate in many ways. Clearly specified and obviously well-known crimes, high-level crimes, treason and bribery, both known to the Anglo-American law at the time of the Constitution. Treason and bribery together constitute a class of offenses that are grounded in the idea that what was done was seriously affected the functioning of government, betraying the country, or shaping government policy for money, presumably to the detriment of the greater public. But what of that other little phrase there, and other high crimes and misdemeanors? Those were not crimes punished by English courts or English common law, except by the High Court of Parliament. Does that mean the Congress is free to make anything a high crime and misdemeanor? Clearly not. The Convention explicitly rejected broader terms. In the first draft, impeachment was to be for, and I quote the first draft of the Constitution, malpractice or neglect of duty. By the time the main writing committee was through with the document, it was for treason, bribery, or corruption, and that was reduced to mere treason by the time it gets to the floor debate where we have most of the recorded debates on the Constitution. And in the floor of the convention, George Mason of Virginia moved to broaden the clause. Mason, I'm going to read just a section from the debate. It's actually the only debate on high crimes and misdemeanors, so you'll get familiar with the language. Why is the provision restrained to treason and bribery only? Treason, as defined in the Constitution, will not reach to a great many dangerous offenses. Hastings, an English Governor General of India being tried for impeachment at the time, is not guilty of treason. Attempts to subvert the Constitution may not be treason as above defined. As bills of attainder which have saved the British Constitution are forbidden, it is more necessary to extend the power of impeachment. He then moves to add, after bribery or maladministration. There's a second. Debate ensues. Madison says, quote, about now or maladministration. So vague a term will be the equivalent to a tenure during the pleasure of the Senate. Governor Morris, Massachusetts, puts in, it will not be put in force and can do no harm. An election of every 4 years will prevent maladministration. Mason withdrew maladministration and substituted other high crimes and misdemeanors. It passed 8-3. This is the only debate recorded in the Constitution on the meanings of those terms. Clearly now from the debate, maladministration was rejected. It would mean the president would hold office at the pleasure of the Senate, implying that removal should not be for light political policy reasons, the equivalent of address of the legislature. For those seeking broad high crimes and misdemeanors, the language of the convention is not helpful. So they often quickly move beyond the language of the convention and they go to the impeachment history. Lots of people are saying that high crimes and misdemeanors has in the past been broadly construed, and they point to any number of various past impeachment trials of federal judges. Indeed, it has become our impeachment practice to convict and remove judges on things that are not criminal violations or anywhere near as serious as treason or bribery. The classic example is a judge in the 1930s removed because he brought his court into scandal and disrepute by accepting large gifts from rich people in his district. No bribery, no cases before him, yet he brought his court into disrepute, was impeached, and removed. Now here I think the proponents of the idea that these cases can apply to the current crisis have made a false analogy. There are two large differences between judges and presidents. First, presidents are elected. Judges are not. Second, the president's term is limited. Judges' term is for good behavior, for life under good behavior. Impeachment has been used to remove judges who have demonstrated bad behavior. The needs that have driven the broadening of the phrase other high crimes and misdemeanors for use against judges have no correspondence in the different situation of presidents. There have only been two times that the House has voted articles of impeachment, against Andrew Johnson and against Richard Nixon. Only Johnson's was carried to trial before the Senate, where he was acquitted. The value of the Nixon precedent is going to run out long before. After all, he resigned from office before the House had a chance to vote on the articles of impeachment. As for the Johnson case, well, let me conclude with a quotation. This one is from our Chief Justice William Rehnquist. Chief Justice Rehnquist has written a book on the process of impeachment. It's a study of the Chase impeachment early in the Republic and the Johnson impeachment. It's called Grand Inquest. And this quote comes from page 271. Quote, "The Johnson acquittal added another requirement as evidenced by the views of the Republican senators who voted against conviction. It was not any technical violation of the law that would suffice, but it was the sort of violation of the law that would in itself justify removal from office." And do remember that William Rehnquist will be presiding if the House votes to impeach William Jefferson Clinton.
This is Talking History. You're listening to scholars from the History and Political Science Departments at the University at Albany discussing the Clinton scandal, constitutional crisis, or politics as usual. Next is Martin Edelman, Professor of Political Science.
I'd like to sort of pick up where Professor Hamley just left off by talking about impeachment in terms of the Constitution, but in terms of the institutional matrix created by the Constitution. Primarily, separation of powers and how that interplays and connects with the impeachment clause. Unlike other systems, the United States Constitution provides only one mechanism for removing a sitting, physically able president, and that is impeachment. And the reason is pretty clear, as indicated by Professor Hamm. It was to operationalize the framers' concept of separation of powers. They really wanted the branches, particularly the legislature and the executive, to be independent. In the famous words of James Madison in Federalist 51, separation of powers was to work with power countering power, ambition to counter ambition. The framers deliberately created a very difficult impeachment process. They wanted to insulate the president from removal for overt political partisan reasons. From having the president destroyed by being sucked into, in Madison's words in Federalist 48, the legislative vortex of combative partisan disputes. Therefore, the criteria in Article 2, Section 4, high crimes and misdemeanors, treason, bribery, and other high crimes and misdemeanors. Now, one thing is clear, high crimes and misdemeanors is not defined by, nor conterminous with, the criminal law. It may overlap, but it's not identical. Therefore, the constitutional text defies exact definition. What is clear, and it's just been illustrated from the history, and comes out from when we read, for example, Hamilton talking about it again in The Federalist, there are actions which relate to injuries to society itself, said Alexander Hamilton. Or a contemporary constitutional scholar, Bruce Ackerman at Yale, in order to qualify as a high crime or misdemeanor, it must be demonstrated that presidential conduct amounts to an assault on the constitutional foundation of the Republic. So what are we talking about? What kind of thing are we talking about? Well, I put it to you that we, those of us my age, and perhaps a bit younger, will remember two things in recent political history. The Nixon-Watergate involvement was plainly covered by high crimes and misdemeanors, for it involved an assault on our competitive two-party system. And I know of no theory of democracy, no conception of democracy, in which free, open, competitive election is not at the very least a minimal criteria for a functioning democratic system. Breaking into the opposition's political party so that you can help determine who the candidate of the opposition's political party will be, when you're, particularly when you're the sitting president, comes very close to trying to turn the system into a one-party state. And you know with what contempt we view one-party states from the perspective of democratic theory. The Reagan-Iran-Contra may be even a worse violation of the Constitution in terms of high crimes and misdemeanors. For what was involved other than the Reagan presidency having, in the immortal words of Oliver North, an off-the-wall foreign policy, an off-the-shelf foreign policy? They had their own little foreign policy running, bypassing the authorization and appropriation process authorized by the Constitution in violation of the law banning aid to the Contras, the then Nicaraguan government at the time. And that's what was involved in it. That is a complete bypass of the system. So while impeachment is in some sense a political matter, because what the House decides, what the Senate decides, if it goes that far, is ultimately not reviewable by any court. There is no way any court in the land is going to be able to intervene in the process that has now begun. An impeachable offense is not basically anything that the majority decides, at least as far as the framers are concerned. Now, we've been over the process in the paper and in the, and Professor Hamm has tracked us through it again, so I don't want to talk about that anymore. Perhaps we'll come back to it in terms of the questions. I want to point out one other aspect of the institutional matrix created by our Constitution, which plays into this particular scenario that we're in now. And that is the independent counsel and special prosecutor. He created an independent counsel special prosecutor law because we had no other way, given separation of powers, of trying to come to grips, to unearth allegations of malfeasance that may indeed border on high crimes and misdemeanors by high governmental officials. We had no other way of doing it that didn't seem tainted right from the outset, because the Attorney General, as we now construe that office, is an agent of the President. There was a considerable debate for the first 70 years of our country that the Attorney General should be considered a judicial figure, but that is historically not the case right now. That's history. That's plainly not the way we function now. Janet Reno is the president's appointee. And many of you are, I'm sure, aware that she has been subject to considerable criticism for not appointing more special counsel, for to investigate other things involving the president, most especially allegations of malfeasance in terms and criminal activity in terms of campaign finance. So we needed a way to get around that. And that was the to deal with allegations of high crimes and misdemeanors by the president and other high officials in those cases where it wasn't abundantly clear on the record right from the get-go. And we couldn't turn to the Attorney General and the office of the Attorney General because it was the president's person. And that was driven home in Watergate when two of President Nixon's attorneys general were themselves indicted as a result of their involvement in the Watergate affair. And one of them actually served prison time. So we created the special prosecutor. In the words of then-Senator Sam Ervin, the chair of the Senate Watergate Committee, and the leading proponent of creating the what was then called the special prosecutor law, which we now call it the independent counsel law, it was to create a mechanism to appoint, quote, an independent official, end quote, in order to separate partisan politics, and again a quote, from the administration of justice. But as we are seeing, that mechanism has failed. The mechanism in that purpose, it has not been able to insulate the office of independent counsel, at least in this affair, from allegations, and the more we get into it, there appears to be more substance and less smoke to these allegations of partisan involvement by this particular independent counsel, both how he was appointed and how he has acted. So that we then have a very strange situation. We have only one way to remove the president, and that's this very torturous, long, drawn-out process of impeachment. And only one way to investigate allegations currently, if they're not immediately obvious that high crimes and misdemeanors were committed, and that's through an independent counsel. We're not so sure that that's any better in terms of partisan politics than having it done by something like the Attorney General. So we're in this dilemma. And this dilemma poses, and this is where I'll turn it over to our colleagues on the panel, a very dangerous political situation for us. This constitutional scenario that I've laid out in terms of our institutions creates a very dangerous political situation for us because it is grinding to a halt much of the policymaking apparatus of our government. Our government functions very poorly without an active participatory president. We suffer greatly when we have a lame duck president. We're going to suffer greatly when, and we are suffering greatly, when we have a badly politically wounded president, not only in terms of a whole variety of items on the domestic agenda, but in terms of international economics right now, in terms of Bosnia, the Middle East, et cetera, et cetera. So this is the decision by the framers to create via our Constitution a rather rigid separation of power system and to insulate the president from partisan attacks in order to reify that separation has its downside very obviously now when we try to deal with allegations of malfeasance.
This is Talking History. You're listening to scholars from the History and Political Science departments at the University at Albany discussing the Clinton scandal, constitutional crisis, or politics as usual. Political historian Julian Zelizer.
First, I want to thank everyone for coming out here. It's nice to see people at a forum outside of MSNBC and CNN where we can talk about these issues. That's one of the reasons behind this forum. Today, I don't want to talk about the impeachment or resignation or even the constitutional crisis. I want to talk about another crisis, I think, that is resulting from this scandal, and that involves the detrimental effects I think this might have on American liberalism in the 1990s. The effect of this scandal will be long-lasting on the president's role in history. The scandal comes at a time when Bill Clinton was successfully redefining and revitalizing American liberalism. He was moving beyond some of the stale debates of the 1980s, and he was helping to invent a new form, you might call it a centrist liberalism, a new way, a third way, that has been gaining popularity in many parts of the country. Following the election of 1996, it became clear, contrary to the conventional wisdom, that the Democratic Party was not dead, nor was American liberalism. But now, in the past 6 months, and I fear in the next year, this scandal will dominate national attention, it will dominate the president's attention, and it will dominate public discourse. This is a time when the president's agenda was supposed to be focusing on issues such as Social Security and Medicare, the crisis in urban America, the international economic, the stability of the international economy, and peace in regions such as the Middle East. But I think that instead of furthering his agenda and these types of policies in a way which would have been possible, public discourse and Clinton's attention now focuses on tales and stories of dress stains. The policies that could have backed up his ideology are languishing. And while historians, I think, might have argued over the strengths and weaknesses of Clinton's agenda, now they might be focusing on sex. It's important not to underestimate how much damage scandal can have on a president's or a politician's role in history. We focus a lot on the short-term implications, as seen through public polling or through the upcoming election, but scandals can absolutely devastate a politician. Clinton only has to look back at a predecessor of his, Wilbur Mills, who is also an Arkansan Democrat, chairman of the Ways and Means Committee from the late 1950s to the early 1970s. Mills was one of the most powerful congressmen of the 20th century, and his imprint was left on all the major issues of the day, welfare, Social Security, income taxation, and Medicare. Mills experienced a spectacular fall from power. In October of 1974, the Park Police stopped a speeding car near the tidal basin, and a woman had jumped out of the car and into the tidal basin, who later became clear was someone who performed locally as Fanny Fox, the Argentine firecracker, a local stripper in Washington. First, Mills' assistants denied that the chairman had been present at the crash, but the story quickly unfolded in the media, and it was clear that Mills was having a sexual relationship with Batistella, which was her name. Mills was also an alcoholic. Initially, the electorate was not as judgmental as one might expect. They reelected Mills, and Congress didn't take action. But a couple of months later, in December, Mills shocked the media and staggered on stage drunk at Batistella's first performance in Boston. At this point, the Congress stripped the Ways and Means Committee of many of its powers, including some of the powers of the chairmanship, and Mills was asked to resign from his position. While in 1974, someone would not have guessed it, this would have a devastating effect in the next few years on Mills' legacy, on his policies, on politics, and on his personality. In terms of policy, it rendered Mills ineffective at a time when many major issues were up for grabs, including a bill for national health insurance and including substantive tax reform. Without someone in that key position of leadership, the chances of that legislation went down. Politically, the scandal helped fuel disgust with Congress, with the Ways and Means Committee, and with committee chairmen. It would take over a decade for the committee itself to regain its standing. And finally, as I mentioned, it was a devastating effect on Mills. Again, it would be hard to believe in September of 1974 that a decade later, most people would remember Wilbur Mills, as one colleague once told me, as the politician who went skinny dipping with a stripper in Washington, D.C. But that is his legacy in history, and I fear that Clinton's actions are likely to leave him and his liberalism haunted by the ghosts of Wilbur Mills. The second major component of American liberalism since the 1960s has been feminism. When feminism became a major political force in the 1970s, one noted writer proclaimed triumphantly, this is a quote, "There is no private domain of a person's life that is not political, and there is no political that is not ultimately personal. The old barriers have fallen." Today, I think that many leading feminists have failed to respond appropriately to Clinton's actions. I fear that they are rebuilding some of the barriers that they once tore down. Since the 1960s, feminism has made a tremendously important contribution to American politics. Namely, they have revealed the sharp distinction between public and private is false and often dangerous. The private is political. Sexual relations that took place behind closed doors in the workplace, for example, were one of the ways in which women had been disempowered in the workplace. This type of thinking led literally to a revolution in workplace relations, particularly between high officials and subordinate workers, where even consensual sexual relations were no longer tolerated and deemed unethical and dangerous. Since the 1990s, I believe that many who consider themselves liberals would agree that if the CEO of a major firm was found sleeping with a young female employee, or a university professor with a young president, or a military official with a subordinate officer, that would be grounds for dismissal or resignation. Within the political sphere, this culminated with the Anita Hill Clarence Thomas confirmation hearing, when feminists mounted a vigorous, and I believe correct, campaign to show that Thomas's private actions towards Anita Hill indicated a weakness and danger in his public judgment. Just as important, the symbolic danger of putting such a man on the highest judiciary body, on the highest judiciary body, would send a chilling message to Americans. It was worth noting that he was accused of making suggestive off-color comments to Hill in the workplace. Feminists were rightly outraged at the hostile environment that created. And while conservatives were derisive toward these types of attitudes in the 80s and the 90s, many in the political left stood firm by arguing that these relationships could cause as many problems as the legislation Congress passed or the speeches presidents made. But I believe that many prominent feminists, women and men, have failed to call for any type of significant punishment, and here I don't mean resignation, as it became clear that Clinton engaged in sexual relations, as most define it, with someone on the lowest rung of the occupational ladder in the White House. When confronted with this issue, the president and his staff have resorted to many of the tactics we might have expected in the 80s, focusing on the woman's sexual past, her past relationships, calling her crazy and obsessive, and focusing on a conspiratorial issue that didn't have anything to do with real issues. Just as politics, I think, has motivated the right in its support and drive for impeachment, so too it has motivated the left in response to Clinton's actions. Feminists have been silent, and some are defending again the distinction between public and private, reversing much of what we have learned since the 1960s. Many are expecting lower standards from a president than we would expect in the business community, or in the university, or the military. Democrats have left Republicans with taking up the charge of sexual impropriety. As a man who promised in his campaign to bring the most powerful First Lady into the White House and who championed feminism in the workplace and the home, I think his actions are devastating. And by standing with their eyes closed before the White House, many are waiting for the crisis to go away. But I think when they open their eyes, regardless of what happens to Clinton, many of their accomplishments will be eviscerated. So the Clinton scandal, I fear, will result in irreparable harm to American liberalism, which was already in a fragile state. Finally, I fear that Clinton's scandal is causing tremendous harm to the reputation of the institution of the presidency. It is helping to fuel a public cynicism about the character of our political leaders, as are the actions of Ken Starr, and it has led to concrete damage, such as the Secret Service being forced to testify and the erosion of the White House counsel privilege. While many say that they don't care about Clinton's actions, at the same time they accept that he's lying and that he was sleeping with an intern in the White House. I think that message can be read two ways. Not just that Americans only care about real issues, but that there is an intense and deep cynicism in our policy.
Our discussion of the Clinton scandal, constitutional crisis, or politics as usual continues. The next speaker is Bruce Miroff, professor of political science. This is Talking History.
The Clinton impeachment effort, I'm going to argue, is the culmination of a process that began with Watergate. It's a process in which each party tries to weaken the other with what political scientists Benjamin Ginsburg and Martin Scheffer have called RIP, Revelation, Investigation, and Prosecution. To quote them, Democrats and Republicans have learned to use allegations of impropriety to discredit one another. Like many honored precedents, Watergate spawned institutional mechanisms that we put to less admirable purposes in what is now the ongoing cycle of RIP. For example, the Investigating Committee, given a bad name in the Red Scare days of Senator Joseph McCarthy and the House Un-American Activity Committee, was given renewed dignity with the precedence of Senator Sam Ervin's committee and Congressman Peter Rodino's Judiciary Committee. The new position of independent prosecutor gained stature from the conduct of Archibald Cox and Leon Jaworski, its Watergate incumbents. But after Watergate, RIP on the Watergate model became a common feature of American politics, particularly under conditions of divided government, where each party controls one branch of the federal government. The Democrats used RIP to go after a long list: Ed Meade, Robert Bork, John Tower, President Reagan himself in the Iran-Contra affair. And the Republicans gave back as good as they got. For example, driving Democratic Speaker Jim Wright and whipped Tony Coelho out of Congress. RIP, again, Revelation, Investigation, Prosecution, is in one respect a calculated tactic, a way to put the other party on the defensive. But it is also something of a blood sport, in which government officials are not only politically defeated, but personally destroyed as well. And as a blood sport, RIP generates sentiments of resentment and revenge that go well beyond political calculation. Consider the figure of Newt Gingrich, the master of RIP on his way up the political ladder, a target of RIP as Speaker, as Democrats yearn for the final tit-for-tat that will even their score with Gingrich. The presidency of Bill Clinton has been the ultimate expression of RIP. Clinton has been the subject of a series of investigations that blur into one another. Whitewater, Travelgate, Filegate, campaign finance, Monica Lewinsky, just to hit the major ones. One congressional committee after another has gone after him. And for every dignified committee chair, like Senator Fred Thompson of Tennessee, who chaired the campaign finance committee in the Senate, there have been at least two partisan bludgeoners. For example, Senator Al D'Amato, New York's favorite son, and Congressman Dan Burton. The one link between all of the disparate Clinton scandals, or almost all, has been the ever-vigilant, ever-zealous Kenneth Starr, a Bible Belt caricature of Boston Brahmin Archibald Cox. True, the Monica Lewinsky affair has been special for two reasons. One, its salaciousness, and two, because Clinton finally had to admit that he did wrong and lied about it. But it is really only the culmination and the fulfillment of 6 years of constant RIP, aimed at driving the president from office. It is important to keep this idea of RIP in mind when we think about the stakes that Republicans have in pursuing the impeachment and conviction of President Clinton. Certainly, I would agree that Bill Clinton has a lot to answer for. Just to name a few things: narcissism, shamelessness, dishonesty, the instinct to save himself no matter what the cost to his friends, his aides, his political supporters. But it's hard for me to believe that his misdeeds, even when they involve violations of law, match the wrongdoing of, say, the Iran-Contra affair. And like Marty Edelman, the contrast has really struck me between these two events. The stakes of RIP have been raised for Republicans not only because they failed to bring down Clinton so many times before,
They've also been raised because of Clinton's symbolic role in the so-called culture wars. Bill Clinton has long represented, for many conservatives, everything they despise about modern American culture. The 60s, moral and sexual permissiveness, cultural relativism, feminism, gay rights, etc. The Monica Lewinsky revelations only confirm to these longtime Clinton haters that everything they always said about him was true. But now, the most galling fact of all is that when finally Bill Clinton stands exposed, a moral monster, the American people could care less. In recent weeks, conservative moralists have taken to scolding the American people for their ethical indifference. Where's the outrage? William Bennett thunders, and many others echo him. Conservative anger at the public reflects a terrible fear that Americans may no longer hold to the family values that Republicans preach. But if Americans are themselves becoming morally hollow, and if Bill Clinton represents the emblem of this hollowness, is the leader in the hollowness movement, so to speak, it becomes all the more essential for the recovery of the nation's soul that he be given the political equivalent of capital punishment. It has often been said, and I think it is correct, that a lot hinges on how the elections on November 3rd turn out. That the results of the election may determine whether the Republicans continue down the path of impeachment or whether they agree to a compromise and a lesser punishment that allows Clinton to keep his office. But I think when we turn to those election results, and they will be critical, we need to see the war that is going on, in a sense, within the Republican Party between prudential calculation and moralistic zeal. Imagine two different scenarios. In the first, if the Republicans fail to make significant gains in the congressional election, and if public opinion polls show, as I think they almost certainly will, that the public is still opposed to Clinton's removal from office, then I think the prudential arguments are almost sure to win out. Looking to the elections of 2000, the Republicans might get what they can, the maximum humiliation of Clinton they can devise, while having to swallow his continuance in office, and something even more frightening, the prospect of yet another Clinton comeback. Because perhaps contrary to the other panelists, I really think Bill Clinton is not as wounded as people think. But what if the Republicans do well in the election, while the polls continue to show the public opposing impeachment? Because I don't see any circumstance in which the polls are going to change very much. In that case, if the Republicans are encouraged by the results of the election, the emotions of RIP, heightened by the symbolics of the culture wars, might well drive the Republican approach. Then we will see a bitter partisan trial in the Senate, with constitutional decorum providing only a thin veneer over partisan rage on both sides. I suspect the Republicans will lose this battle, and they may pay a political price for it in the years to come. But we will all pay a political price for the ugly spectacle of the trial of Bill Clinton, in the further souring of the political process and the deepening disenchantment of the American citizenry. If the politics of RIP began with Watergate, the Senate trial of Bill Clinton may well represent Richard Nixon's final revenge on us all.
You're listening to a panel discussion by scholars from the History and Political Science departments at the University of Albany. The discussion focused on the Clinton scandal, constitutional crisis, or politics as usual. Following their presentations, the panel took questions from the audience.
I think there's some serious legal issues involved here with the very question of perjury, which the last time I looked is a felony. Anyone or all or somebody respond to that?
Without doubt, perjury is a felony. But I think most courts and most citizens view perjury in terms of what are you lying about? What is the root cause? What is the event that you're lying about? And it's, are you covering up murder? Are you covering up an illegal affair? And I think it's the nature of the underlying cause which somehow shapes the view of perjury. And as I said in my remarks, the phrase high crimes and misdemeanors was not meant to cover illegality per se. It was meant to cover those crimes that go to the damage of the society itself. And you'd have to play out in a very long line of instances, while this bad example of the president would be more damaging to the fabric of our society than many other missteps that our chief executives have made, both legal and illegal, in the past, to think that this warranted, at least in my view, coming under the rubric of high crimes and misdemeanors.
And if we're talking only perjury in the federal grand jury, not in the deposition, the other thing that I think should come into play in this is that the independent counsel set what is commonly called a perjury trap. That is, if they had asked any single one of us that very question, we would have sat there and taken the Fifth Amendment. For political reasons, the President of the United States is not going to go on and give a videotape testimony where he's going to take the Fifth Amendment. The other thing probably to be said about perjury is, and taking the oath, our law has always been somewhat ambivalent about those oaths of witnesses in court. It's important to remember that for much of Anglo law, much up until the 1890s in England, a felon could not testify on their own behalf because they were presumed to, they would commit perjury, and they were silent in the courtroom. They could not speak. They could not tell their tale. And the liberalization was under the idea that they probably might lie, but that there would be a chance, perhaps, for truth to come out. So the perjury, you know, you say it's a solemn oath, but in many ways the courts have already begun to treat it as just a contested version of truth.
Let me just add one thing, which is to remember that, in a sense, whether Bill Clinton committed perjury or not, and I suspect he did, he was operating under novel circumstances that no previous president has had to face. After all, remember, no president had, until the Supreme Court decision, had to face a deposition in a civil suit against him while in office. No president had to appear before a grand jury before him. In a sense, Clinton is operating under new circumstances in which a president is now subject to these judicial processes. And again, counterfactually, if you go back to American history and imagine independent prosecutors and civil suits, you know, that every president in American history had been subject to, and whether, you know, some of them might have committed perjury as well to cover up various kinds of things, it's an interesting question. So Bill Clinton may be the first president who committed perjury, but he's the first president who's ever been in this kind of situation before, where he's been grilled and forced to give testimony and deposition.
In the dealings of the independent counselor, special prosecutor, what checks or balances do you think, can be put in place on the office? Because it's now, you know, I've heard it called the fourth branch of government, sometimes the fifth branch, depending on how many people you listen to. You know, yet it seems to be created outside the other three branches, outside checks and balances and separation of power. So what can be done to perhaps prevent this kind of thing from happening again?
Okay, let me just elaborate first on the special nature of the independent counsel. As that office was created, and the laws, by the way, will sunset next year, it must be reenacted every 5 years. At least that's the way they've drafted it up until now. The special prosecutor, who we now call an independent counsel, is given all the authority vested in a U.S. attorney, except he has an unlimited budget and is limited in terms of the mandate of what he can investigate by the charge given to him by the special three-judge panel, three judges from the Court of Appeals selected by the Chief Justice of the United States, who on a petition from the Attorney General decide who the special prosecutor, if there's one, is warranted, and if so, who that independent counsel will be. And that's the limit on it. It's not limited to necessarily to public affairs, that actions that were taken in office, though that was plainly what was in the mind of Sam Ervin and the Watergate generation. They were thinking of actions taken in office by the president or other similar high officials. They were not thinking about things that took place in Arkansas years before that governor of that very small state even thought about, well, he probably always thought about, but even before he ran for president of the United States. It has an unlimited time, unlimited funds. It creates a real problem. So some people have argued that one way you can get rid of the independent counsel is the independent counsel can be fired by the attorney general. But that, of course, just gets you even further into that political maelstrom that you created the office and the whole institution in order to avoid the attorney general now acting. And you will recall that in Watergate, in the Saturday Night Massacre, President Nixon asked the attorney general to fire Archibald Cox. The attorney general resigned. He asked the deputy attorney general to fire Archibald Cox. The deputy attorney general resigned. He then asked the number three man in the Department of Justice, the Solicitor General, Mr. Bork, and Mr. Bork carried out his order. So to have Attorney General Reno fire Mr. Starr now is as inconceivable to me as it would be, as was mentioned before, President Clinton taking the Fifth Amendment before the grand jury. I mean, just not in the political cause. Well, so some ways of reforming the office have been suggested. One that's been bruited about in the press is to limit the nature of what can be investigated only to actions that take place in office and to more sharply define the offices, the president, the vice president, and maybe a couple of cabinet officers like the attorney general herself. Maybe not even other cabinet officers because presumably the attorney general can get at them. My own favorite suggestion is that we follow something akin to what the Brits do, the Canadians do, the Israelis do. That is, you make the attorney general a nonpartisan office, term limited, but a nonpartisan office, like we make the CIA director, the FBI director, and the attorney general is in charge of all prosecutions all across the country. All the prosecutors report to that type of person. And the administrative aspects of the attorney general's, current attorney general office, running the prisons, the Immigration and Naturalization Service, giving advice to the president, continue in some other office that we would name. A minister of justice is the way they call it in Israel. In Britain, they call it a home secretary. So we can do that. And there was some talk, as I indicated, in the early years of our country of envisioning the attorney general functioning that way. But somewhere around the Civil War, that possibility became an historical nullity for us right now.
It's very difficult to conceive how you can do that. And that's the one bipartisan thing since the 60s has been the hatred of the independent counsel at different times, depending on who's in power. Remember, Bill Clinton lobbied very hard to support the independent counsel as well, and Republicans attacked it at different points in the 1980s.
You've been listening to a public forum by historians and political scientists on the Clinton scandal, constitutional crisis, or politics as usual. This discussion was taped on October 15, 1998, at the University at Albany. Our thanks to Professors Martin Edelman and Bruce Miro from the Political Science Department, Dan White, Richard Hamm, and Julian Zelizer of the Department of History, and the audience. This edition of Talking History was produced by Susan McCormick and Gerald Zahavi. You've been listening to another edition of Talking History. This segment was produced by the Department of History, University at Albany. Talking History is a co-production of the History Department, University at Albany, State University of New York, WRPI-FM Troy, and the Department of History, Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska. For more information about Talking History, write Talking History, Department of History, University at Albany, 1400 Washington Avenue, Albany, New York, 12222.